Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of This Week in Doom. Joining me, as always, the green chicken himself, Doomberg. Mate, how are you?
Grant Williams, I'm doing fantastic. And I always love sitting down and chatting with you. We could do this, to be honest, every day. It'd be so much fun.
I know, but, right?
I mean, seriously, and as we were just joking a little bit before we turned on, the news fairy continues to deliver, doesn't it?
Ain't that the truth? You know, it's remarkable. Every day there's a new story. And I don't know if this is a social media phenomenon. Maybe this sort of pace was actually always there before, but we didn't have the instant means by which to communicate it, and a lot of it got lost in the fog. But now you just get bombarded with these stories and they get picked up. You know, we're recording this on the 6th of September, which is, what, a Wednesday. And, you know, yesterday, well, the last two or three days, we've seen this whole NVIDIA thing start bubbling up with the story of CoreWeave. And, you know, I'm sure there's more of that to come. You know, I don't need to rehash it, but it's amazing how quickly these things take hold and the power that social media has to give people a means by which to kind of disseminate these stories.
Yeah, and it's funny because this is the strength and the weakness of Twitter laid bare in the same story, right? But this had been percolating below the radar on Twitter from nearly the moment they announced their third quarter earnings. And it's not something that I don't know well enough to write about, but I'm certainly reading with quite interest. And coincidentally, of course, we had written a piece about Masa-san and Arm and their IPO, which is related to NVIDIA and his attempts to try to capture that wave. But yeah, Twitter, of course, and at the same time, we're seeing Twitter's ongoing, interesting evolution under its new owner as well. And so it's been a remarkable couple of days for social media, no matter how you slice it.
It really has been. And we'll come back to Masa-san and the Arm deal, because I thought that was, to me, one of the best pieces you've written. I thought it was absolutely superb. But I want to kick things off with your most recent piece, which you published, I think, was it today or yesterday?
It would have been yesterday.
Yesterday, Money Talks. Why don't you run us through the outline of it and then we can dig into it? Because I thought it was, again, another superb piece of writing.
Well, I appreciate that. At the highest level, Grant, Money Talks was just one piece in a theme that we have been observing, which we really can't wrap our brains around, which is there's this vast cadre of elite intellectuals in the West who have convinced themselves that not only is it a good idea to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, but we shall do so in periods measured in years. In fact, I just read the other day, I think it was in Bloomberg, where somebody just nonchalantly said, we expect to cut our fossil fuel use by 35% between now and 2030. And 2030 is not that far away. And I can assure you, I bet my mortgage, that come 2030, we will be consuming more fossil fuels, not less, and certainly not 35% less. Because if we're consuming 35% less, there'd probably be a billion or so less of us on the planet. And so this amazing dichotomy between what the learned class of the West believes to be true and what's actually going to happen on the ground comes to a head in many different ways. And one of the more amusing ways in which it came to a head, which was the focus of Money Talks, was this amazing development that a European law firm masquerading as an environmental group called Client Earth filed an official complaint with the United Nations, essentially calling Saudi Aramco a pariah under international law, an abuser of human rights, because not only do they currently produce fossil fuels, but they intend to do so for decades to come. And for this crime, they need to be punished. And we go into the piece about how this cadre of rapporteurs got together and penned this very serious sounding letter and sent it to the CEO of Saudi Aramco and copied all the banks as if anybody cares what this letter says. And then, of course, within the days of this letter landing on the desks of all of these banks and the CEO of Saudi Aramco, BlackRock, of all firms, and Larry ESG Fink, of all people, puts the CEO of Saudi Aramco on his board. And the rest of the piece sort of just writes itself after that. But it was a really fascinating, I don't understand it. I don't know how people who are otherwise intelligent can say with a straight face that we're going to cut fossil fuel use anytime soon by any meaningful amount. They don't know what they're talking about. And most of the rest of the world placates that view and pretends like it's not going to matter because it doesn't directly affect them yet. But eventually it has to come to a head. 2030 is coming. 2050 is coming. We're not going to meet these goals. and nobody's actually listening to you. And the whole point of the piece is to lay out where the real power resides. And I'll finish this answer by saying that, as we asked in the piece, what could the world do without oil or the United Nations? it's not a very tough question, you know. So it really does fascinate us. This is an amazing psychology experiment that's playing out right before our eyes.
Your question was one rooted in pragmatism, right? And that seems to be the missing ingredient. And whenever we have these conversations, I just fail to believe that these people really do believe this is what they're capable of. They just feel like they need to signal this is what their aims are. You know, we've had a more pressing thing. I'm in the UK at the moment, and we've had a more pressing example of this here with the ULEZ, the ultra low emission zone in London, which came into force on the 29th or 30th, the end of August. And it basically means that if you drive a car that was built before a certain date that is deemed not clean, and you drive into this ULEZ zone, which is basically the inner circle of the M25, which rings London, you have to pay, you know, $15 a day or whatever it is. You know, it doesn't matter if you're going to work, doesn't matter if you're going to see, you know, if you're someone that drives in to stay with some relatives, say your parents get sick, you drive in, you stay there for a week to look after them. Even if you don't drive your car on the road, the fact that it's in this zone for that week, you're racking up $15 a day tickets. And this was the Mayor of London's great idea some time ago. And now, of course, it's here. And the enforcement of this has met with massive non-compliance, huge amounts of vandalism for all the cameras that are taking the license plate information down, an incredible amount of anger. And it's kind of fed through to the politics. The Prime Minister has tried to persuade the Mayor of London to back down. He won't do it because obviously it's political suicide for him to do it. And you just watch these people tie themselves in knots, having multiple years prior come up with this great sounding gimmick that will help us win votes because we're going to be green and we're going to be thoughtful and we're going to do this stuff. And the very fact that we're here now shows you how much it's possible to do when given a few years head start. And the answer is really not very much, because they've screwed it up again. So your point about 2030 coming soon, it's coming really soon, and it's coming far too soon for anything meaningful to be done.
I love this story because it unpacks all aspects of the energy debate that we have today. So first of all, climate alarmism is a luxury of the rich, and policies implemented to abate the worst aspects of what many believe are humans' carbon emissions on the planet, it inevitably becomes incredibly regressive, both within countries and between countries. And so, of course, the wealthy in the UK can afford to drive whatever car they want into the heart of London, and the poor people can't. And of course, the rich countries can indulge themselves in heat pump mandates and in electrification campaigns, where, you know, the 250 million people living in Pakistan are struggling to keep the lights on. And on top of that, it's all just a show. I mean, what does the characteristic of the vehicles in a certain area of London have to do with the weather? And how will this crazy policy actually impact global average surface temperature 50 years from now? It won't.
This is, I guess, the whole point of this thing, right? It's a tent pole in the ground that people can dance around. We're doing something. We can't do nothing. It's not an option to do nothing. We have to do something. This is something, therefore we're going to do it. You know, this is this great line from Yes, Prime Minister all those years ago, it's a great English comedy series. This is something, therefore we're going to do it. And it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And your point is absolutely correct.
Well, worse than that, Grant, our actions have consequences. And what we tried to outline in the piece, of course, is that Saudi Arabia and MBS, having sensed weakness on the part of the West, has ensnared us in a game of be careful what you wish for. If you would like less fossil fuels, I'm happy to do that, because that's just going to spike the price more than the volume I'm cutting back, and I'm going to make more money. My reserves are going to be more valuable. The shares of the Saudi Aramco company are going to elevate in value. And I'm going to win. It's like heads I win, tails you lose. And more we're seeing OPEC Plus and the Global South, where because of our own environmental NIMBYism, much of the production of fossil fuels and much of the production of the critical minerals needed to execute the so-called green transition, these countries that are blessed with these resources and have the willingness to develop and exploit them now have all the power. And look, let's just take Europe. You know, we said in a piece a couple of months ago, we developed what we call Doomberg's postulate, which is every molecule of fossil fuels produced will be burned by somebody somewhere. And local restrictions on who gets to do the burning merely shift the privilege. And so every drop of gasoline not burned because of this crazy policy in the City of London is going to be burned somewhere, because there's no shortage of cars in the world, and people will greedily accept that energy, as they should. And so the Global South is awakening to the leverage we have handed them.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I wanted to come on to that because you went through the data in the piece, and I'll let you lay it out. But talk a little bit about the Saudi cut back in, I guess it was June when they first cut production, which caught a lot of people by surprise. Just walk us through that timeline and what's happening in the interim, because it's a very telling timeline.
Yeah, so in June, MBS announced that they would cut 1 million barrels a day of production. It was just to give people a benchmark. 1 million barrels a day is roughly 1% of total demand. And in the beginning, the price of oil as measured by Brent, the Brent crude contract, was kind of flat, didn't really, you know, react to the news. And then suddenly the data started to coming in, and people saw that the Saudis were serious, and they announced that they would extend it. And suddenly export data from Saudi Arabia is the lowest it's been in some time, and down some 2 million barrels a day from just earlier in 2023, as we showed in the piece. And Bloomberg broke that story because Bloomberg does a great job of tracking down to the tanker level such data. And then suddenly the price of oil skyrocketed. It's up 20% from the lows of the end of May, early June, when this new policy was announced. And, you know, we have been fortunate with some good timing the last couple of weeks, but the morning we published this piece, Saudi Arabia announced that it would extend those cuts through to the end of the year, and oil took the next leg higher. And as we say in the piece, if 1% of global oil demand, a cut of that supply, can spike prices by 20%, like, that just shows you how inelastic and how critical to life oil is. Oil, as your friend Luke Romans likes to say, is the master resource, right? And oil is the ultimate currency. And Zero Hedge put a tweet out yesterday that I saw, because we still lurk on Twitter. Of course, we don't participate on it anymore. But he said, you know, the U.S. is weaponizing the dollar and OPEC Plus is weaponizing oil. Let's see who wins. It's very clear in our view who is going to win. And MBS, through his actions, have proven that. And then we go on to talk about how, perhaps uncoincidentally, Saudi Arabia is pondering another sale of equity in Saudi Aramco itself, which is a behemoth. You know, the market cap, admittedly, it trades only in Saudi Arabia, and one has to wonder about the quality of the data coming out of that market. But it has ostensibly a market cap of $2.2 trillion, and they're looking to raise another $50 billion. And we talk in the piece about how the bankers will knock themselves over in the mad dash to participate. They're not going to worry about some letter from the United Nations claiming that they are facilitating, quote, human rights abuses by helping Saudi Aramco raise money. It's really a fascinating thing to see, and it is truly a metaphor for the completely different worlds these people live in. They're so detached from reality. Our next piece, which might publish by the time this podcast does, is we're going to do a piece on the upcoming COP28 meeting in the United Arab Emirates, and the tentative title for it is Cop Out. And we're predicting that that media will devolve into a farce, and it's almost inevitable that it will. It's really, ultimately, the promises we've made with respect to climate change, those checks are going to bounce. And the time that those checks are set to bounce is nearing. And it's going to be amazing to see how politicians walk themselves back from the edge or dive over the cliff, because those are the two choices.
Well, when I think this thing through and you think about the way out for these guys, it obviously is to find someone to blame, right? That's the only real game in town here, because you're right, they can't really walk back. They can't really deliver on what they've promised. They're going to need to find someone to blame. And that's kind of the piece that worries me, because I can't quite figure out yet who the scapegoat is going to be, but I guarantee you it'll be a dumb decision. Whoever they choose to scapegoat, it will have ramifications down the line. You know, when I did a podcast with Mike Rothman a couple of months ago, you know, and it's so refreshing to talk to someone like Mike, who's been immersed in the oil market for decades. And to him, it was perfectly clear what was going on. He doesn't listen to any of the climate stuff. He doesn't listen to any of the mandates. He just looks at the oil market and said, it's structurally tight. The oil price is going higher. And then you get the political decisions being made. You get the depletion of the SPR in the US and the refusal to refill it. Not just the refusal, but the telling the market that you're not going to refill it, which, again, you know, I look at the Biden administration's energy policy from every direction possible. And every direction you look at, you just seem to see a bigger set of clowns at the wheel. I'm just, the whole thing it just blows my mind, whether it's the fossil fuel angle or it's the nuclear angle, it feels like they're trying to screw this up every which way they possibly can.
At least the U.S. produces an enormous amount of its own energy, and netting out imports and exports is probably a net energy producer. Europe produces less than 2% of any of the major fossil fuels. And so it's in no position really to impact global emissions, because ultimately, as we said earlier, you know, Doomberg's postulate says that every molecule of fossil fuels will be burned by somebody somewhere. And the only way really to limit emissions is to limit production, which is why, by the way, Client Earth is attacking the Saudi Aramcos of the world, and why environmentalists have moved sort of upstream trying to stop the production of these fossil fuels, because they realize that consumers are going to continue to use whatever is available to them at an affordable price. And so this is why we are watching Germany so closely and the rise of the AfD and the response of the German political establishment to that. This is a protest vote. Like, whatever you think of the full menu of AfD policies, people are upset, and Germany is deindustrializing. And in fact, I saw a great post on Substack, I forget the author, but they mentioned that the concentration of the support for the AfD, of course, resides in what we would call Old East Germany today, where they have not really been fully integrated and have been treated perhaps poorly by the ruling class from the Old West Germany. And so ultimately, we view this as a protest vote. And we called this last year, you know, if you do this wrong, you're going to trigger a populist revolt, a right-wing revolt. And how that is handled is going to be very fascinating to watch. And I would say that we are a couple of weather accidents away from social unrest in Germany. I don't think that that is too doomy to make as a prediction. And in fact, let's see how the winter goes. A strike in Australia is suddenly causing, you know, gas prices to perk up a little bit in Europe because things are so tight. And as we have warned, like, you should not confuse good fortune with sound strategy. And it seems like this is what's occurring, especially in Germany. So Germany is the ultimate test case. No country has spent more on renewables. No country has a dirtier grid proportionate to how much they've tried to clean it. And no country is at risk for perturbations in the weather or disruptions in the supply chain globally. A war between China and the U.S. would certainly not help. And so, you know, it's a very precarious time. And as we said in the peace money talks, we do believe that MBS and the rest of OPEC Plus are pressing that advantage. They don't need to sell the oil in the ground. It'll still be there. It'll still be worth something. Why not jam the price 20%, make the same amount of money, and keep our reserves for a rainy day?
Well, you know, you mentioned Germany there. If you look at the economic data coming out of Germany, it's just awful, right? Every single number coming out of that economy right now is terrible. So it's clearly struggling in every kind of aspect.
Well, industry doesn't just vote on the current data. Industry votes on the forward-looking political assessment as well. Because if you're a chemical company, BASF or Dow or DuPont or pick your favorite, and you're going to make a multi-billion dollar capital investment, you have to plan on a 10, 20, 30-year time horizon. And the political situation in Germany has proven to be a significant headwind to new investment. Even just keeping the facilities you have now, the maintenance capital, is pretty substantial. These are kind of terrible businesses. They're capital intense, price takers, and volatile products. And so high fixed costs as well because of the capital intensity. And so it doesn't take too long a period. Even if natural gas is $10 a million BTU today, LNG, you know, down from 100, it's still four times the price in the U.S. And last I checked, the Gulf Coast is replete with petrochemical facilities that are competing against the same petrochemical facilities in Germany. The products are globally traded, so there's basically one price. And the cost advantage to anybody that has access to cheap energy is going to cause the deindustrialization that we have seen in Germany. And this is all quite predictable. And, you know, when Germany avoided the worst-case scenario risk, which we were the first to say that we were happy to see, many people were saying, aha, see, you were just alarmist. Well, let's see the full price that's being paid. And let's do a full accounting of what has transpired 5 years from now and see who was alarmist and what the consequences truly were.
Let me bring you back for a second to this Aramco deal, because you made a really interesting point in the Money Talks piece, you know, when you asked the question, who might be interested in participating in this deal? You know, because it is trading cheap. It is only trading in Saudi. And that ordinarily would frighten a lot of institutional investors away potentially. But you had a great answer to that. So I want you to walk us through that, because it's really, really fascinating.
I will give credit where credit is due. I'm building on the work of Luke Roman and your great podcast with him. And I read Luke every week, and everybody listening should, because it really does great work and always makes me think. And if you view your reserves as stored potential energy, i.e. you need to take the money in your reserves and eventually buy energy with it, which would you rather own? It's an interesting question. U.S. Treasuries or a piece of the largest oil producer in the world. Now, you have to make some bets about the political stability of Saudi Arabia versus the political stability of the U.S. But at the same time, if you're China, not necessarily a straightforward bet, is it? And in fact, there's probably a lot of evidence that developing an alliance with Saudi Arabia would be a safer bet than trying to placate the ever-changing administrations of the U.S. You don't know who the next president is going to be. You have a pretty good idea who's going to be in charge of Saudi Arabia come 2030. And so if your objective is to ensure that your excess reserves preserve your purchasing power in oil terms, what better way to do it than to own a piece of the largest oil producer directly? And we're seeing cross-investment. China is, of course, pitching Saudi Arabia on buying its nuclear power technology, which, of course, Saudi Arabia would roll its excess profits from the sale of energy to China into and diversify its own domestic energy resources. Now, there's many people who believe that this is just a game of chess that MBS is playing in the hopes of getting a better deal from the U.S., and we shall see. That's an interesting milestone for us to observe in the coming weeks and months. But nonetheless, I don't think that it would be very difficult for the same banks that receive this sternly worded letter from the various rapporteurs of the United Nations to place that $50 billion in pretty short order. And I suspect that the countries lining up to invest in Saudi Aramco are the same countries that are thinking about their long-term energy policies through the Luke Roman lens. And so that is why we sort of try to connect all of those dots in the piece.
But you know, there's a couple of things there. Firstly, the level at which and the places within which these stakes would be held are the sort of places that have a direct line of communication into MBS, right? These are going to be held in sovereign wealth funds. There's going to be a great amount of understanding about how this little game is going to work if we take up a big chunk of Saudi Aramco when you list it, because obviously we're doing you a favor. We're giving credibility to the Saudi Arabian Stock Exchange, and there will be quid pro quos in terms of stability and in terms of backstops for these positions. But also, it's been fascinating watching MBS, you know, because as you said there, he's clearly using the leverage that's been handed him by the West to strengthen his position and to play one side off against the other. And as I talked about in a recent piece I wrote, in a recent speech I gave, you know, he's exactly where he wants to be, which is aggressively courted by both sides. And that's another real change, because the Saudis have always been Western facing, and they've always had this very strong relationship with the West. And it's very interesting to see in the last couple of years just how the confidence level of MBS has risen in terms of being able to push back and to dally with China and dally with Russia and really do whatever he wants without the kind of stick being held over his head by the US in terms of, you know, play nice with us the way we always have and everything's going to be fine. He's obviously realized that he's in a much stronger position now. The US slash the West is in a much weaker position. And he really is literally in the middle of all this and wrapping a lot of these guys around his little finger.
So 2 points on that. One can't help but wonder about his safety
yes,
in the years ahead, right?
Agreed.
I mean, let's be realistic. There's no shortage of precedent in that regard, which you have detailed in much of your writing. And then a little headline crossed wires, again, perhaps under the radar of most, but caught our attention, which is I see that Saudi Arabia and Iran have now exchanged ambassadors again, which is sort of a fulfillment of a deal brokered by who?
Yeah, China, exactly.
And so he does seem to be playing both sides, but I think his reaction to Biden's reaction to the murder of the reporter at the Washington Post, which everybody would agree was a dastardly human rights violation, is such that the relationship with Biden and MBS seems to be strained, if we're going to be polite about it. And so he might be playing both sides, but I think if push came to shove, it seems like the disparity between the treatment Joe Biden received when he landed in Saudi Arabia versus Xi Jinping is an affront that nobody could miss. Right. This was all by design, of course. These things are highly choreographed. So back to my original answer, one wonders about his safety. I mean, Libya, Iraq, pick your favorite. the track record of people who have meaningfully tried to disrupt the dynamic between the U.S. dollar and oil is not a particularly glorious one. And let's be real about it. And so one wonders how the world would react to such a development.
But I think that's why this particular thing is so interesting, because previously, you know, Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi are the two most obvious examples of what you've just described. Neither of them was Saudi Arabia, and neither of them was the leader of Saudi Arabia. This is a whole different level of power here. This is the central pivotal figure in OPEC. And I don't think that this is something that can be handled in the same way, particularly given how much closer the Saudis are to the Chinese, to the Russians, and how desperate everybody who stands against the kind of Western alliance is to have the Saudis come over to their side of the playpen, if you want.
Well, I've been fascinated by your new podcast series, Chaos Theory, and pulling on that sort of military threat has been really fascinating for me, because like you, this is nowhere near my zone of expertise, as we might say. But it might feel like it's different this time, but do they have another playbook? I'm not aware of one. Now, again, this milestone that we're watching, the deal that seems to be on offer is a sort of grand bargain between the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia, in which Saudi Arabia receives nuclear technology for domestic civilian purposes from the U.S. in exchange for committing to various non-proliferation objectives, which they seem to be balking at. China has come in with undercutting bid, from what I hear, 20% less per gigawatt, which is attractive to the Saudis. One wonders whether they're just using this as part of leverage against the U.S. in a complex game of 3D chess. But if we see Saudi Arabia signs a nuclear deal with China across the wires, I think all bets are off. If we see the base assumption, which I think the market is pricing in, which is eventually MBS will come into the proper camp, proper in air quotes, then kick the can down the road a little bit longer. But this is the next major milestone. And so seeing the exchange of ambassadors between Saudi Arabia and Iran would weaken the case, we think, for a full, you know, rapprochement with Israel. But again, maybe not our area of expertise, but just as interested observers, that was a very curious headline.
Well, it's been fascinating to watch. And one of the things I do for fun is co-host a sports podcast, Good Are You Not Entertained? And we've talked about this in the sports world for quite some time now, the Saudi influence. And it's been fascinating to watch the way the Saudis have gone about trying to move into the world of sport, which is obviously very high profile. It's ubiquitous. And the two sports they've chosen, golf and football, for the time being, we'll see what happens further down the line. But to watch the abandon with which they have sprayed money at these things. You know, the numbers that they've talked about in the golf world with the LIV Golf Tour were just beyond belief. You know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars being guaranteed to these golfers to bring across to something which, you know, I'll get loads of pushback on this because I do, but it's just the way I feel about it, is an immensely inferior product that to me has a very limited shelf life. And so to watch the Saudis do that, to try and take over one of the most popular rich guys' sports, a sport which attracts the biggest companies in the world to sponsor it because it has the right demographic. And then to watch them do the same thing with football, which is the everyman sport right across the world. And you know, sitting in the UK, we've seen the Saudi money coming into the game here. You know, my own team, Fulham, have lost one player. We've got the manager being courted. We've got another player being courted days after he signed a new contract. And the money that was being thrown was extraordinary. And so to see these teams in the Saudi league try and buy Liverpool's main striker for £150 million right at the close of the transfer window to be rebuffed and to come back with a next offer, not of £155 million, but £200 million, only to be rebuffed because Liverpool had no time to find a replacement for him, to find the next number being whispered is £215 to £225. It just tells you that this is a power game, pure and simple. And we can pull money out of the ground. We are going to spend it left and right. And what we're seeing in the oil markets now, what we're seeing with the production cuts, is a means of paying for this, as you say, right? We just put the price of oil up. We make it up on volume. And we finance all these different ways that we can spread money and influence right across the world. And sport is such an important place to do that, particularly in the world of football, which is, you know, I know it's not as big in America, although thanks to Lionel Messi, it's getting that way now. That game reaches the homes of billions of people around the world, and it's the same game everywhere in the world. It's a common thread that we've seen here in the UK. We've seen the Saudis buy Newcastle United, a big, big team. Think New York Mets in baseball, you know, a big team in a big city that have kind of not won anything for a long, long time. And there's an Amazon documentary about this now, and I was watching a couple of episodes a week or so ago, and it's amazing to watch these fans being interviewed about human rights abuses and saying, yeah, but we want to win. And so the influence and the power that the Saudis can buy with this money, can buy through raising the oil price, I think they're finally starting to piece this together, Dumi, and understand what they can do just by putting the money in the right place. And as you say, they have the means to strangle the oil market, to keep the price high. There's so much going on here that all feeds together into a very, very different Saudi Arabia to me, one that is trying very methodically to absolutely change its place in the global pecking order.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I love that podcast that you do. And I'm a big sports fan myself, and I have observed this. And in my own career, I should say, of course, I've never met MBS, but I've probably been one degree of separation away from him on several occasions, you know, in the early days. I do think there is an angle here that you might find interesting, which the way in which they go about this is actually particularly poor on a return on investment. And I do think they get bad advice. Far better, if I could have bent MBS's ear, to have struck a deal with the PGA where you become title sponsor, you pour a bunch of money into the PGA, this overpaying for assets and loudly splashing your money around is uncouth to the audience that you're trying to court.
Yes and no. And I think that's the difference between golf and soccer. In soccer, they just don't care. The fans do not care. They just want to win. And if you have a new owner who has completely bottomless pockets, you don't care about anything else. Golf is different. I agree.
I think they could, but even in football, you could have had a higher bang for the buck than the way that I see them going about it. I do believe that this concept that they are poorly advised, because the bankers are in it just for the fees, and they will tell him anything he wants to hear, even with the sovereign wealth fund and the private investments and the entanglement with Masasan and Vision Fund 1, which I'm sure we'll get to, all of that could have been done much better. And I think it is a symptom of a broader disease of they're so rich that people will tell them whatever they want to hear in order to get their slice of the fees from whatever transactions occur. And so I do think the sports metaphor is important because it does feed into one of our axioms, which is it's entirely possible that the most powerful person in the energy world is poorly advised and makes bad decisions. And people aren't necessarily working that into their models, you know, the sort of rational actor hypothesis of economic theory. And nobody would say that what the Saudis did in the world of golf was anywhere near rational. In fact, unless you're a player, because even the players that stayed behind on the PGA, I noticed that was just amazing. I was thinking like this. At first, I thought it was inflation, but in reality, it's the Saudi effect. The winner of the FedEx Cup got a $18 million check, and second place got six. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when $6 million put you in the top 10 on the money list. I remember when Tiger Woods would win $1 million for winning the Masters. $18 million for a relatively small field tournament. Now, of course, I get it. It's a season bonus and all those other things, but it's still $18 million.
Well, it was 10 when the FedEx Cup was launched, right? It was
10. 80%. Yeah, 80%.
Yeah. I think this idea about bad advice, it's only that if you assume that these investments are made around the potential return and not around the potential shift in the power structures. That's what I think. There's a combination of bad advice. There's a combination of greed on the part of the bankers, but there's also a case of we don't really care because a financial return is not our primary objective here. Our primary objective is to shift the power base, shift our standing in the world, shift the way people look at us, shift the way the culture looks at the Saudis, about oil. There's so much at play here that is beyond money that I don't think making uneconomic investments is necessarily a problem.
Yes, I agree, because they could always just squeeze the market and make more money. So in a sense, they're sitting on top of the world's greatest ATM machine. But still, I do think there were better ways to go about it. There were better investments to have made. But nonetheless, it is fascinating. I do think having this price agnostic wildcard in the mix in the most important markets in the world, whether it be venture capital, sports, or the energy markets, is an axiom that one must consider when you're trying to model things out, because it truly is a wild card.
Well, I would encourage everybody to pay attention to the sports world, because that seems to me to be the leading edge of this. But you mentioned Masson, you mentioned price-insensitive players, and nowhere have we seen anything approaching that in terms of the Vision Fund and MBS himself. So that brings us to your other piece that you wrote, I think, a week ago about Masson, which, again, I wasn't fully au fait with a lot of the stuff. And as I was reading this piece, I'm just sitting there shaking my head going, oh, man, this is just absolutely preposterous. I should have guessed it would be that bad. But but really, until you see it laid out. So walk us through Arm's Length, which I think was the name of the piece.
Yeah, Arm's Length, one of my favorite titles, actually. Look, I should just say up front, I love Masson. I love everything about the man. He is a source of endless entertainment to us. And I just think he is so audacious that, you know, the world is better for him, even if he is ultimately the catalyst for a major financial crisis, which I think both you and I think is a distinct possibility, given how big he has been allowed to grow. We both love opening our pieces with a story. And I have this reservoir of stories that I might read a couple of years ago and then just keep in the back of your mind. And one of my favorite was the story of Oyo, which when WeWork was popular, fancied itself as the WeWork of cheap Indian hotels. It was led by this amazing kid, this founder, Ritesh Agrawal, who's by all measures a brilliant, dynamic kid, but he's a kid. He's in his early 20s when he founded Oyo. And for those that don't know, at least at the beginning, but prior to COVID, Oyo did the WeWork model of offices, but for hotel rooms. So they would go to various hotels and they would pre-buy rooms at a discount, but at a fixed price guarantee to the hotel operators. Those hotel operators would be expected to elevate to the Oyo standard. And then with their BizWang fancy app, they would work to fill those rooms with travelers looking for a deal. And we both know that this is a business model that works great until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, you go insolvent. And as others have pointed out, it's very easy to grow a financial services business quickly, just give away a lot of value. And that's essentially what Oyo did. And Masson's Vision Fund, which the Saudis are major investors in, perfected this model. They would flood startups with hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, far more than they were looking to raise, hoping they would put all their competitors out of business, create a monopoly, and then charge monopoly prices. And one of the CEOs that Masson backed was this Ritesh Agrawal. And a most curious headline crossed the wires, where this kid bought $2 billion of his own company back from founding investors at an amazing, eye-watering valuation of $10 billion. And when it first hit, we thought to ourselves, where does a kid who hasn't had an exit yet get his hands on $2 billion in credit to buy shares in a fledgling startup from none other than Sequoia Capital and Lightspeed Venture Partners, two of the shrewdest cutthroat names in the venture capital world? And this transaction, which essentially was a secondary, some of the money found its way into the startup, but most of it went to Sequoia and Lightspeed. It doubled the valuation, and that became the headline. Well, we only found out later that he borrowed the money and leveraged a personal guarantee from Masson himself in so doing. And so really, Masson marked his own books. I mean, let's be honest. This thing was priced at $5 billion, and two of the biggest names in the VC world wanted out, which normally would have been a negative headline. And to facilitate their exit from Oyo, effectively, Masson lent money to this kid, who then used it to buy out these big name VC funds at twice the valuation, which through the power of his own signature then allowed Masson to write up the value of his investments in Oyo at the Vision Fund and in SoftBank, and in so doing, allowed him to, you know, report better than expected earnings. And coincidentally, he has pledged a big chunk of his personal stock in SoftBank for margin loans. And the real point of this piece, which is really about the ARM IPO and NVIDIA, which we'll get to, but we were motivated to write this piece because of Ben Hunt's great work on options and the managerial class and stock buybacks. There's another angle to that, which is even more perverse, which is when the highest executives of the company pledge their stock for collateral as loans so that they can enjoy the wealth that their stock appreciation should give them without having to sell. But in so doing, it creates an even more serious principal agent problem than the one Ben Hunt has spent so much time working on, which is now you're on the hook to the banks and you can't ever let that stock price go down because then you would face a margin call. And Masasan is the king of this. It, as we said in the piece, it's a Russian doll of debt. And so this story of Oyo and Masasan's recklessness in that regard is the opening for what he's tried to get away with this ARM IPO, which is truly fascinating and led to my favorite all-time Doomberg sentence that we have ever written, because ultimately...
Well, hang on. Save that sentence until you've told the story, because it'll be so much better as a punchline to the story, because there'll be people out there, not many, I'm sure, that aren't familiar with ARM. Everyone's familiar with NVIDIA, so it's a fairly simple set of dots to connect. But before you do, and it is quite the payoff, walk us through the story of ARM vis-a-vis the Vision Fund first and what ARM do, because it's important to understand that, I think, given the way the mania is rising.
Okay, so in 2016, SoftBank took ARM Holdings, a UK-based designer of computer chips. They took it private for $32 billion. In the next year, the Vision Fund bought 25% of ARM from SoftBank for $8 billion. So flat valuation to what Masasan took it private for. Now, Masa controls both the Vision Fund and SoftBank. And so this is hardly an arm's length transaction, which is, you know, the name of the piece. But he doesn't own all of it. So effectively, it was a sort of a liquidity injection into SoftBank using ARM as the conduit. So heading up to ARM's IPO, which everyone on Wall Street is hoping goes off with a big bang, because, you know, the IPO market has been incredibly flaccid as investor appetite for unicorn startups has waned in the face of 5% T-bills. They're trying to take this thing back to the public markets. One of the reasons why Masasan wants to do this is because banks are willing to lend him more against his stock collateral because it's a public market instead of a private one. And so in the weeks ahead of this IPO, SoftBank bought back from the Vision Fund that same 25% stake, but it did so at a valuation of $64 billion, or twice what they had sold it for back in 2017. Yeah. And he wanted to have this be this psychological anchor just ahead of the IPO. Oh, well, you know, the last transaction was $64 billion. But in reality, this is not really a transaction in the typical sense, because who else would do these things but Masasan, right? And by the way, as we said in the piece, he kind of bought this piece back from the Vision Fund on layaway. He's going to make payments over the next 2 years. Like there's nothing this guy won't borrow against. But the killer line in the piece and my favorite all-time sentence is, it's kind of two sentences, which I'll just read. But with the financial world anxiously awaiting the start of ARM's roadshow in the hopes that Sun can reignite the flaccid IPO market, Sun has decided that his chip maker is worth $64 billion because Sun agreed to buy a chunk of it from Sun for that price. And then here's the killer. In so doing, Sun agreed to pay Sun twice what Sun sold it to Sun for 6 years earlier. And then we included the Spider-Man meme of four, four Spider-Mans pointing at each other. And it really is just so ridiculous on its face. Like, and when you read that sentence, the best part about that sentence is it lays bare the farce without calling it a farce. Anybody with any financial knowledge whatsoever reading that sentence knows precisely what's going on here. And in between the time we publish this piece and when we're recording this, it seems as though the IPO is not quite going to plan. The latest anticipated or indicated valuation is somewhere between $47 and $52 billion, as opposed to the $64 Masa just promised to pay the Vision Fund for it, you know, several weeks ago. And nobody is as reckless as Masa-san, which again, as we started this part of the podcast by saying, I genuinely, the man makes me smile every time I see him. I mean, he is truly one of a kind and is a treasure to content creators like us.
To content creators, absolutely. You know, it's funny, when you look back at the WeWork thing, and I think Apple did a great job with that series they did with Anne Hathaway and Jared Leto, We Crashed. If anyone hasn't seen that, I would recommend watching it. It's very, very well done. But you know, I remember writing about WeWork way, way, way back in the day because it was so utterly ridiculous to me that this thing, A, the business model didn't make any sense to me, and B, the numbers didn't make any sense, and C, the founder was clearly so full of it was absurd. But, and I think this is the important point, and you touched on it a short time ago, when interest rates were zero, everybody was willing to play along with this game. Everyone was willing to look the other way, ignore all the nonsense, and get behind these and give these deals a shove. Because, hey, how else are we going to make money? We're not going to make it with 0% interest rates. But now that we do have those 5+% T-bills, the game's very different. And I think we're starting to see that reflected in the fact that this ARM IPO, people are now, they know this is the same game that went on before, but now they don't need to take the risk of playing it in order to make decent returns. And I'm on record many times as saying at the time this started happening, this is going to change everything. And I think this deal potentially flopping relatively, it's still going to be probably a profit on the original $32 billion deal, but it certainly shows you just how the appetite for risk and the appetite for these kind of half-baked dreams and stories that went so well 2 or 3 years ago just doesn't work anymore.
So let's be very clear. ARM is no WeWork. I mean, ARM makes
money. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But the story is it's a similar inflation of the valuation.
Right. But let me challenge you on the... So $32 billion isn't really what he paid for it because now he's bought 25% of it back for some fraction of his non-ownership at a $64 billion valuation. And by the way, the $32 billion was invested 6 years ago. And what has the NASDAQ done in that intervening period? And so... our view, and the reason why we wrote the piece over and above our fascination and affection for Masa-san, is, in fact, it could potentially be, and time will tell, a real catalyst for a leg down in the market. Masa-san himself is running a giant confidence scheme. I wouldn't use the P word necessarily, but I would say confidence is a key input into the valuation, and that valuation is a key input into the collateral for all of the Russian doll of debt that he and his company and his various other enterprises have taken on. And Lord knows what we would find if we were able to pull it all apart. I wonder sometimes if he even knows. but as a metaphor for the risk appetite of the market, because there is this debate, you know, hey, we've raised rates 5% and the U.S. isn't going into a recession and the markets are holding up well. And there are many wondering whether we've pulled the pin on the grenade, but it just hasn't exploded. And as a hunch, as a marker to lay down, if this is a flop, and we're not saying it's a flop, it might still go off. And Lord knows, you know, he's only floating 10% of it, and the meme crowd might take it, and we might look pretty foolish because it'll be valued at 120 or 500 billion. I mean, who knows? So we certainly wouldn't short it, and we should be very clear that we would not go long and we would not short it, and we don't give investment advice, because if I knew how ARM was going to go off in the IPO and how it would trade subsequently, I wouldn't be writing, I'd be trading. And so just to be very clear about that. But if it does flop, or if they pull it, which actually I think is possible, because if he doesn't get the mark, he doesn't have to remark. He might pull it and quote market conditions as the reason. That could be a dent in confidence. And then the whole NVIDIA and the things we referenced earlier, you know, NVIDIA has really carried the stock market. If this is truly sort of late 2007, early 2008 vintage market dynamics, then it could set up for a pretty interesting fall and early winter.
Well, there was one other detail of this deal that I wanted you to flesh out, and that was the kind of hiding in the extremely lengthy list of material risks disclosed by ARM. Talk a little bit about the Chinese connection, because this is just fascinating. I knew nothing of this until the original piece.
Oh, they don't own ARM China. They own 48% of it, but they don't control it. And they're trying to bring to market a designer of chips that is reliant upon Taiwanese production and access to the Chinese market at a time where this is the beating heart of geopolitical tension in the world. And again, leave it to Masa-san to pop that bubble, you know? So essentially, ARM China was stolen from SoftBank, and Masa and team worked through the Chinese courts to get some semblance of economic value salvaged from that transaction. But in reality, 25% of his revenue is subject to the whims of President Xi. And in fact, one of the reasons why ARM isn't growing is because of the trade war and the chip war and ARM's inability to sell its highest end designs into China, which is a growing market. And so, as we detailed in the piece, this is not a growing company. This is a mature company that makes a reasonable amount of money. But at a $64 billion valuation, it would trade at a revenue yield of 5%, which last I checked, you could get with a 2-year treasury with no risk, and a net income yield of 0.8%. And so I don't know that 47 to 52 billion is the right number for a company that has huge geopolitical risk. Look, if the Cold War between China, the US, and Taiwan escalates to a hot one, companies like NVIDIA and ARM are particularly susceptible because their entire supply chain essentially comes from Taiwan. They don't make chips, they make designs, and they catch a vig on the intellectual property that their research and development has generated. And that when interest rates are low and the world is at peace and the U.S. Navy is doing its thing over the blue water, that's a great business model. At a time with 5% interest rates and thoughts of war between the China and the U.S. over the Taiwan issue, and you have Kyle Bass at various right-wing political think tanks making the case that war is imminent, maybe it's not worth $64 billion. And so we shall see. Again, these markets are crazy, as you know. I mean, this VinFast Vietnamese electric vehicle company being the third most valuable, quote unquote, automotive player in the world because they floated less than 1% of the shares. And somehow this got through the SEC, which is probably a topic for a whole other This Week in Doom. It tells you the markets can go crazy. So again, we're not making a call. We're just pointing out that this is a milestone worth watching. And however it turns out, will be a very strong indication of where we are in the markets, which really, as an investor, is all you really want to know.
Yeah, couldn't have put it better myself. Look, the breadth of your pieces this month has been truly extraordinary. I congratulate you on each and every piece you've written. And I know people love to get your thoughts on energy, but I think this piece about SoftBank, for anybody out there who hasn't taken the time and trouble to read it yet, you really should, because it is a fascinating story. It's a lot bigger than the company and Masterson. It potentially, as you just laid out, has much broader ramifications. And so people should try and stay abreast of these things because, you know, as go these high-flying stocks, so goes the market. And it doesn't need to be a bet on ARM. It doesn't need to be a bet on Masterson. It doesn't need to be a bet on NVIDIA. And everyone seems to think if there's red flags in these things, you worry about that particular company. The way the market is and how narrow it is right now, I'm much more worried about the broader market if these big companies fail. So again, congrats on the writing this month. It's been really broad and really exceptional, even by your lofty standards.
Wow, that's very kind of you to say, especially from the from our idol. And so it's been great talking about a couple of our pieces and looking forward to doing it again.
Well, listen, for anybody that hasn't, I have to give you this opportunity to let people know, if they haven't read either of these pieces or any of your other work, how they can do that, because it's worth their time. Absolutely.
Yeah, you can find us at doomberg.substack.com. We are no longer active on Twitter, so you'll find us on Notes on the Substack platform as well. And if you're listening and you're not a paying Doomberg subscriber, feel free to send us an email for a copy of both of these pieces. We're happy to give you a preview so you can get a sense of the product and see whether it's worth your precious money. And we'd be more than happy to earn your business. But yeah, that's where you'll find us, doomberg.substack.com. Very small team, do all the work ourselves, answer every email ourselves. And so yeah, Grant, as always, a great pleasure. And actually, looking forward to seeing you again in person soon, as we have been arranging offline. And it's going to be a really fun time. Can't wait.
Absolutely. Well, listen, for anyone that heard that generous offer and doesn't take you up on getting a free copy of those two pieces out of their minds. So hopefully everybody out there listening to this who hasn't read them will do just that. What's the best email for them to get a message to you to do that?
Doomberg@protonmail.com is the best email, which I should have said, of course. Just asking people to email you without giving them an address is probably not going to convert. Yeah, Doomberg@protonmail.com, and it will be read by either me, the head writer, or the editor-in-chief. Those are the only two people who have access to our email address, and every single email from a subscriber gets a thoughtful answer. Pride ourselves on responsiveness to our subscribers, and so if you want a couple of free copies before you decide to take the plunge, we're happy to send them along.
Fantastic. All right, my friend. Well, listen, I will talk to you soon, and I will probably see you even sooner. It's always a pleasure having a chance to chat. So thanks again for doing this, and I'll see you soon.
You bet.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.